North Carolina's million-plus elementary and secondary students are now back in school. Those schools have been legally desegregated since the landmark Brown versus the Board of Education case in 1954, but is that truly how it is in North Carolina? Is desegregation the same as integration? And is integration the best thing for our schools? The newly published collection, School Resegregation, Must the South Turn Back?, attempts to answer some of these questions, and we'd like to hear your answer. We're talking about desegregation. Has it been turned back? Are we resegregating our schools? How important is it that they be desegregated? How important is it that they be integrated? 877-962-9862 is the number to call. We're joined now by Jack Boger, who is a co-editor of the book, School Resegregation, Must the South Turn Back? He's a professor of law at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And Charles Klotfelder is a contributor to the book. He's a professor of public policy and economics at Duke University in Durham. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
The subtitle of the book, Must the South Go Back? Is the South going back on integrated schools? Charlie?
We looked at North Carolina. My two co-authors, Helen Ladd and Jake Vigdor, and I looked at North Carolina. In North Carolina, there is an increase in measured segregation. You can measure it several ways, and there is an increase. The South as a whole is increasing only by one measure, but by other measures, not so.
And what accounts for that? What accounts for the difference?
One of the biggest things that's going on in public schools in the South and the nation as well is a change in the racial composition. And a lot of these measures compare where whites are going to school versus where other students are going to school. And the whites as a percentage of the total, it's going down. And so some of the measures have the fortunate or unfortunate effect of making it look like there's more segregation when there's not. In the state of North Carolina, any way you measure it, the increase is there.
Jack, we asked the question in our introduction, is desegregation the same as integration? And certainly as far as the court is concerned, it is not. Is that right?
No, that's certainly the case. But what's happened, I think, to increase the amount of segregation occurring or resegregation occurring in North Carolina schools is partly attributable to the change in the court's attitudes. The Supreme Court had long supported active efforts to end racial segregation. Beginning in the 1990s, the Supreme Court decided three cases which, in effect, told school districts, hurry up with your action to achieve desegregation. We're going to let go of federal supervision. And then in 1999, the Fourth Circuit, which is the intermediate appellate court that governs North Carolina, Virginia, and some other states, in effect said that school districts no longer under court order could not, even if they wanted voluntarily, assign children in order to maximize racial equality. They could not engage in race-conscious student assignment. And I think that's had a big effect.
And in particular in Charlotte Mecklenburg schools, you trace the change over time. When the school district was under court order, there was an improvement. Schools were less segregated. As the enforcement it becomes more lax in the 90s, we see a change.
Charlotte is almost a poster child of resegregation. If you look at a graph that at something like what percentage of the African-American students are going to schools that are basically all black, that number starts at 100% in the segregated age. It just drops precipitously down to virtually zero in around 1971 when the Swan decision comes. And it stays very, very low until right around 2000 when it begins to inch up. And then as a result of or at the same time as the decision that Jack just mentioned, it's going back up in a significant range.
We are talking today about resegregating the schools. Our guests are Jack Boger, co-author and co-editor of the book School Resegregation, Must the South Turn Back? And Charlie Klotfelder is a contributor to that book and a professor of public policy and economics at Duke University. We're taking your calls at 877-962-9862. Just ahead, more of your calls. Support for the State of Things comes from listeners who support North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. We are talking today about resegregating the North Carolina schools. There is collective agreement that integration in theory is a good thing, but how is it working in practice? as we head toward the resegregation of our public schools. Is that where we're headed? The research seems to say it is. And is that necessarily a bad idea? We'd like to hear from you. 877-962-9862. We're joined by Jack Boger, who co-edited a new book called School Resegregation, Must the South Turn Back? He's a professor of law at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Charlie Klotfelder is with us. He contributed to that book. He's a professor of public policy and economics at Duke University in Durham. And we're joined now by Reverend William Barber. Reverend Barber lives in Goldsboro, a city that is evenly divided between African Americans and whites, but city schools are almost entirely black, while county schools are white. Reverend Barber has filed a complaint with the U.S. Office of Civil Rights in Washington. Reverend Barber, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here today. I was listening as I came in to the earlier report that you all had on and the discussion. I'm particularly sensitive to it. My doctoral work is in public policy and theology. So I see this both as a moral issue and as a political issue. In Judeo-Christian thought, how you treat children is a very, very serious issue morally. And I often put it like this. I think that this whole business of resegregation, particularly where we are in Goldsboro, you have a city that's 50-50 black-white. You have a majority white city council, but an all-black inner-city school, all seven schools.
Well, how did that happen?
Well, it happened. Several things happened. The school used to be integrated inside of the city. At one time, you had a city school and a county school. And we have a base, as you know, Seymour Johnson base, where there was a time that the base children went to the schools within the city limits of Goldsboro. Slowly and systematically, new schools were built, and they grafted those students away from the city school system. In fact, now we have a situation where some white kids who are actually in the city schools attend this area bypass Goldsboro High and are bused some 5 to 7 miles to schools out in the county as opposed to the school right there. So we have a high school now, for instance, that 49% of the kids are failing, and it's about 400 seats are open in a school.
And that may be the result of the CHOICE program that started in Goldsboro. Am I right about that?
Well, CHOICE, but more importantly, what they call an open transfer policy, mm-hmm. where on the one hand, you don't allow kids, you say that you can go to whatever district you want to. But the problem with that is morally inconsistent because we say that we believe in diversity. And it's economically irresponsible because when the kids are allowed to leave the schools in the city, then you have open seats, but then you bust the seams of the schools outside the city limits. Then you want to raise taxes and have bond issues to build additional schools that you really don't even need.
But is the choice, the same choice is available to people in the city to move out?
Well, no, it's not. That's one of the things that we're challenging. It's available, but something being available and something being economically possible is altogether different because the kids that are in the heart of the city don't have the car transportation and those other things to be able to move out. So, you know, you can tell me that I can move, but then you know feasibly it's not possible for me to move.
You know, Reverend Barber, you raised the moral question and suggest that this is really a serious moral question. I was interested in the research, Jack Boger and Charlie, Charlie Klotfelder, you talk about in the book the fact that racial attitudes appear to have softened in North Carolina at the same time classroom level, and this is now classroom level segregation, has increased. Tell us a little bit about that phenomenon and what accounts for it.
I'll take a stab at it. The first thing to understand about these measures is that North Carolina, compared to other states of the Union, is relatively, with some exceptions, fairly not very much segregated. Wayne County, Goldsboro, is a real exception. But as a matter of averages, the state is not nearly as segregated as Michigan, Alabama, Florida even. One of the things that Vigdor and Ladd and I looked at was segregation within schools. And most of the measures don't look at this. But that is a real phenomenon here as it is in other states.
And we should explain how that happens and what we mean by that, classroom segregation.
if you have an advanced track or a gifted track, or if you have two levels or three levels of English, those students are not randomly distributed across the way, and often it's the case that additional segregation is established by having these different kinds of classroom setups in the schools. But
So the school population might be integrated, but then as we get into the classrooms, we're going to find largely black classrooms and largely white classrooms within what would otherwise look like an integrated school.
You could watch
the kids march in and out.
But the fact at the elementary level in the state of North Carolina, there's very little. But this begins to raise its head in middle school and then with a vengeance in high school.
Mm. Let me jump in to say that while Charlie notes that North Carolina isn't as segregated as other states, that's of course because there was a struggle that went on for 20 or 30 years to move North Carolina from a highly segregated set of public schools in the 1950s and earlier to what we had by the 1970s and 80s. And as a white North Carolinian, I was sort of grateful for and proud of that difficult struggle to bring desegregation. That's what makes, in my mind, it's so troubling to see North Carolina slipping away from that degree of high desegregation for the moral reasons that Reverend Barber talks about and for educational reasons as well. There are really two purposes of our public schools, and one of those purposes is to educate individual children and bring out their highest and best attributes. But we have a very important social purpose in public education in shaping our next generation, and that next generation is going to be demographically diverse. But if we don't bring our children together in our schools, they will not know how to deal with each other across racial and ethnic lines. And that seems to me a critically important future concern.
Yeah, Reverend Barber, when you talk about the struggle in this state, Goldsboro was not under a court order. You talked about the fact that they had been integrated, the schools had been integrated.
In the 70s.
Right.
There was first a city school and then a county school, and then they worked a legislative process to merge, to unify the school system, but there was no court order, no consent decrees or any of those things to guarantee these percentages. But again, when we look at the warp speed at which we are seeing segregation, and particularly for me being east of I-95, it is devastating. I mean, in terms of what's going to happen to housing developments in cities, business recruitment. You're not going to be able to recruit businesses when in a lot of business organizations now they recognize it's economic suicide not to have diversity. The tax burden, when we're raising money to build schools we don't need. We're talking about an $83 million bond program now to build new schools in Goldsboro, and we've not even redistricted and utilized the space that we already have. So I like to say that it's morally inconsistent, it's economically irresponsible, it's socially insensitive, I think it's constitutionally illegally, and I know it's historically ignorant for us not to address these issues of segregation.
Let's focus on the economics of that for just a minute, because it's interesting that in Wake County, when they went to a countywide school system, they used that very argument, the idea that if we're seeing a decline in the city, one of the ways we can stem that is to integrate our schools and stop this flight out to the suburbs. We can actually do that by developing good integrated schools.
One of the things my research has shown so clearly is that when you begin to allow a racial segregation to recur, you also set up a system in which there are higher poverty and lower poverty schools, because sadly enough, African American Latino parents have less dollars. What that begins to mean is that you've got schools, high poverty schools, in which learning is more difficult. We're not talking about racial issues now, but economic issues. That makes it hard not only to attract businesses to those schools, it makes it hard to attract good teachers, because good teachers know they're going to be in a tougher learning environment. What Wake County did is to, in effect, say, we're not going to have any high poverty schools in our district because we're going to assign children to avoid that. And so wherever you settle within the county, you can know as a parent that you're going to have a quality school.
So they use not necessarily a racial cut or racial filters to screen, but they used other indicators that more or less indicate good schools rather than racially diverse schools. That wasn't that part of the formula?
That's correct. Mm-hmm. And yet, because of the correlations between race and socioeconomic status,
right,
that diversity of socioeconomic status in the schools also means racial diversity as well.
877-962-9862 is the number to call if you want to join our conversation about resegregating schools in the South and in the U.S. in general. Tim is on the line from Raleigh. Hi, Tim.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good.
Yeah, I just wanted to, a couple of things. Number one, I don't really get the moral element that the Reverend keeps bringing in. It seems like he's just saying moral doesn't mean it's a moral element. But more specifically, I wanted to address the fact that what's going on is that people have tried desegregating schools, and they didn't work. So that's why they're going back to, they're kind of drifting back into a segregated school system. My parents went to segregated, well, they went to Catholic, the two best Catholic schools in D.C., Gonzaga and Sacred Heart, Stone Ridge Academy, and they were, you know, devout liberals, so when we were growing up, they kept us in the segregated school system, and it was a disaster. I did not like it. I sent my kids to a Catholic school because I'm not going to put my kids through that, you know, I'm not the only person that feels that way. People in my generation, all of them feel that way.
All right. Well, Tim, let's get a response, and thank you for your call. Reverend Barber, why is this a moral issue?
Well, I think, first of all, we have to recognize that when the law of the land was segregation, Plessy versus Ferguson, it was legal, but the civil rights movement took it on as a moral issue and said even though it was legal to have segregation, it was immoral, both constitutionally and biblically. And again, I think your caller points to something that we really need to deal with, is an expansion of this whole moral debate. Primarily in Judeo-Christian faith, morality is focused on the poor, how you treat the poor, how you treat children, and how you treat the most vulnerable of a society. And resegregation and the way it's happening is affecting all of those. We just heard the comment about how you create these low-wealth schools. When you track resegregation, you can also track dropout rates. You can track performance gaps. You can track the number of inexperienced teachers are being routed many times into the various schools that are being resegregated. And that's what I mean, it's a moral issue from a Judeo-Christian perspective.
Good. Go ahead, Jack.
Let me add that I disagree with Tim that integrated schools didn't work or were disasters. Certainly there's been a variety of experiences, but there have been lots of successful experiments in desegregation. Parents, black and white, who have experienced desegregation, by and large support it, find it good for their children. There's a 19th century quote that readers may be familiar with. The problem with Christianity is not that it's been tried and failed, but that it's been tried and found difficult and therefore not really tried at all. Mm-hmm. To some extent, there are places where desegregation wasn't given a fair chance, and for black and white children, it was difficult. But that is not a necessary consequence.
Well, is there any way to, how do we measure what was going on in Charlotte, Mecklenburg, for instance, when we saw a decrease in desegregation, an increase in integration? I mean, were things better for people, and is there a way to measure that? I mean, I assume we're talking about a better education and a better school experience. Charlie?
I'm not sure I can give you data on Charlotte, Mecklenburg, but I can follow up one of the points that Jack made. One of the things that we looked at over the last few years was the chance that a child would get a teacher that had never taught before. So a teacher in the first year. Evidence shows that teachers do get better in the first couple of years, but in the first year is often a struggling year. We looked at the chance that a white student in the state of North Carolina would get a rookie versus a black student, and we found that in math in the seventh grade, that a black student had about 11% chance, a white student about 8% chance. The numbers in English were about the same, so it's about a 3% difference. This could not happen if the schools were racially balanced, so that segregation, to any extent, it leaves open the possibility that there can be real resource differences.
Well, let's talk about the how this debate evolved over time from Plessy. You know, there was a robust debate within the NAACP about how to pursue this. And at first, Thurgood Marshall prevailed and he had the minority view in the NAACP, saying, no, let's get the dominant feeling was, look, it says separate but equal. We're not getting the equal part. That would be the moral part of this. Let's get the equal part in there and forget about this integration stuff because these white folks are never going to go for it. I mean, that was the initial argument. Is that worth pursuing? Is that line of reasoning now still worth pursuing? Let's get the resources to the schools where they belong and end the political debate.
Yeah, I would suggest that what we call in theology, that might be a false dichotomy. I think it's both and, not either or. I think Thurgood Marshall had to take on, as you said, whites and minorities. He had to take on white supremacists and African-Americans. And I think that's still a dynamic today. I might get in a little trouble about this, but I think that African-American leadership needs to step up to the plate and really, really begin to address this issue. I do think that we have to broaden it. It's about race. It's about class. I think we need to follow the money, too, because I'm concerned about who's getting all these contracts for all these new schools that we're having to build because we continue to foster resegregation. I think we need to take those issues on. But I don't think it's either or. I really do believe it's both and. And I will be admit, I felt sometimes like Thurgood Marshall. I had an African-American one time say to me, why are you even concerned? Your kids are in good schools. You got a kid, you know, with a graduated valedictorian, another one that scored 1100 on the SAT. You just ought to just be worried about them. And for me, I have problems, real serious problems with that kind of dismissal of responsibility. Yeah.
What about, too, it's interesting in the Grutter case. This is the case of the University of Michigan Law School that said ultimately the decision found that race can be used as a way to integrate school systems at the college level, university level. But it was interesting to see who weighed in on that argument. You had Fortune 500 companies saying, if we don't get kids coming out of integrated schools who understand different cultures, we're in trouble. We can't compete. You had the military saying, we can't run an army if we don't have kids coming out of integrated schools. So you have the business sector and the military, the two key components in American society today, saying, if we don't have integrated schools, we're dead.
Indeed. Beyond that, colleges and universities, liberal, conservative, north, south, east, west, filed briefs as well saying we need racial integration in our higher education in order to create citizens who can do the world's work in a multiracial society. So it's an irony if the military and the corporate sort of leaders of America and higher education all say this is a desperately important thing for students to get, and yet in K-12 education we're drifting away from that kind of goal.
Housing is a big issue. We always hear that as the real reason behind this. People are choosing to live in neighborhoods, and that's where the segregation occurs. So, of course, we're going to see segregated schools.
But racial segregation in housing is decreasing. The 2000 census showed that in the South and in other areas, there is more diversity in housing than there had been 10 years or 20 years earlier. So the explanation for racial resegregation in schools is not increased housing segregation.
And we found in our work that in North Carolina, children are less segregated in schools than they are in neighborhoods. So traditionally, the schools can be leaning against that wind.
We are talking today about the resegregation of schools in America and particularly how it affects North Carolina. The Reverend William Barber, Jack Boger, Charles Klotfelter, all in the studio. We'll take more of your calls in this next segment, 877-962-9862. Did you live through segregated schools in our state? Is segregation or integration even a goal we should be reaching for? 877-962-9862. When the state of things continues, stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. We're talking this hour about the possibility of North Carolina's public schools resegregating. The numbers certainly indicate that that is happening. The Reverend William Barber, Jack Boger, Charles Klotfelter, all here with us in the studio. We're taking your calls at 877-962-9862. Did you live through an era of segregated schools? Did you go to an integrated school? And how have things changed over time? 877-962-9862. Before the break, we were talking about housing and its relationship to segregation in the schools, and it's a complex relationship, is it not?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I one of the reasons I was glad you invited me, I was the former director of human relations, and I'm actually running for state conference president of NAACP, and I think we've got to get on this issue. We are when you're having schools that are segregated or resegregated, we know on the ground level that persons are being steered outside of those communities when they come into the community in terms of building their houses. They're being steered away from the inner cities. That is an examination of how that is a major violation of the Fair Housing Law, which was passed in 1968, is worth our consideration. Because again, what I see this doing is the state of the schools is creating a deficit in the inner city. I often call it, it's like having a donut and the inner city is becoming the hole. And it's directly tied to the schools.
Well, and Jack Boger, too, one of the essays, one of the articles in your book, School, in the book that you edited, School Resegregation, talks about ways to remedy that allow for integrating the schools that actually has an impact on how people choose and where they choose to live.
Sure. There's an interaction between where one chooses to live and obviously where one's child goes to school. And if you start to create, as Reverend Barber suggests, racially identifiable schools that are connected with neighborhoods, then realtors and many home buyers will start to settle in the portion of the community that attends one school or another based on its racial composition. And so that sort of accelerates all of the tendency toward resegregation in the society. It's an unhealthy trend.
Let's go to the phones. Dave is on the line from Raleigh. Hello, Dave.
Hey, thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
As a parent of two young students in our Wake County school system, I certainly became aware of an issue relating to integration here just recently, and that's the orientation night for the students. And I can tell you that it was very similar in nature to the graduation ceremonies last year and to most of the ongoing activities throughout the year. And that's that when I went, and I'm a Caucasian parent, my children are Caucasian, the Hispanic students, which represent about a third of the population, were very well represented by their parents, many times mothers and fathers. The Caucasian students were very well represented. The black students were represented almost not at all. And when it came time for the awards for attendance in the schools, there were none of the black children that got zero of the students got attendance awards. And I would have to say that the Hispanics got far more than the white kids, even though they only represented a third probably versus the white students representing 40% of the students in school. And I would guess, as someone who hires a lot of people in my job and has had the pleasure of working with people of all races, I think you're going to see the Hispanics come in and dramatically outperform the black students in the next 5, 10, 20 years. I just can't imagine how one of your guests mentioned that morality was taking care of children and looking out for the children and the impoverished, etc. Well, then it must be that a lot of these black parents are just morally bankrupt. In so much as they don't seem to be fostering the educational environment for their children. They're not actively participating in their schools. And I can tell you that my wife is a teacher, and not in Wake County, but in an adjoining county, and the vast majority of the problems she's having with behavioral and other issues are not coming from the Hispanic students, it's not coming from the white students. And I know it's not a genetic issue, I'm not making some type of racial separatist type of argument, But the parents of these children, if they want them to succeed, have got to stop calling on the government to fix their problems.
All right,
and they've got to start fixing the problems themselves and make their kids behave, make them start not emulating gangsters and all this other stuff that goes on in school. They got to get them to shape up.
All right, Dave. Well, let's get a response because we've got quite a bit there, and I want to have time to respond for it. Thank you very much for your call.
And first of all, 70% of gangster rap is bought by white students. And when you deal, and 70% of arrests in America are not blacks, with 20% of the population, with 65% of the prison population, but that's a whole nother issue. What I think I hear your caller saying is that, look, I agree with you that parents ought to be responsible, and that is a moral issue. That does not stifle the moral issue of the public school systems being what they're supposed to be in terms of being integrated and well-funded. I would encourage you not to engage in a false dichotomy. I agree with Bill Cosby and Michael Dyson. Bill Cosby, where he's been calling on people to step up to the plate, we've always done that in the African-American community. Be careful not to make generalities, because sometimes if 1% of the African-American community does something bad, you blame the whole 90%. I could point to you 70-80% of parents who are working hard every day, doing the right thing, who want the same things you want for your children. The problem children and problem parents do not excuse a problem public school system.
There's another suggestion that comes out of this very discussion that shows that whether kids are middle class or poor, they will uniformly do worse in poverty schools and poor schools, and they will uniformly do better, whether they're poor or middle class, in those middle class schools. So it's something about the resources that go to the school and the quality of the school that has an effect on the students and the parents, I assume, who go there? Is that what the research shows?
Can I mention one other thing that just came to mind about your caller? You know, this false notion of pathology. We felt that was, remember, historically, that was the same argument that people used throughout the South to fight segregation the first time. They would send flyers around with black kids depicted as apes and criminals and hurting little white kids as a way to try to scare the community. My argument is this is not just a black issue, integration. It is a North Carolina issue. It's a people's issue. It's a Constitution issue. It's a right issue.
Yeah, our evidence in Charlotte is really pretty dramatic. Frank, going back to your point just now, the evidence shows that if you have lower-income children who are attending high-poverty schools, 64% are at grade level. If you have lower-income children attending socioeconomically integrated schools, 82% are at grade level. So among children, all of whom are poor, there's an 18 percentage point difference depending on whether they go to schools that are socioeconomically isolated or not. And obviously for African-American and Latino children, insofar as the schools drift in that direction, they're going to find the performances lower than they would otherwise be. My experience, by the way, is very much like Reverend Barber's. We see lots of really excellent African-American students come into our law school who have worked hard, who have come from middle-class families, who care a lot about education, et cetera. I do think there may be some differences, frankly, predicated on the history of poverty and economic differences. If one is from a very marginal family in terms of economics, it's harder to get free at 7 o'clock on a Tuesday night to come to a back-to-school night than it is for somebody who, in fact, is in a higher socioeconomic status and has a little more free time.
Let's go to Henderson. Cindy is on the line. Hi, Cindy.
Hi. I just wanted to say I'm living in Vance County now, but I did live in Wilson County in 1997 when my daughter attended an inner-city school that was very successful and had some of the very highest test scores. And it was predominantly inner-city African-American school with a lot of volunteers of Caucasian women that didn't work, that volunteered. They had a lot of volunteerism. And then in around 1997, they stopped that integration, and they started building schools, and the school became all African American. And I know the school didn't do as well when that happened because they lost their volunteers. And I was kind of shocked by the other Caucasian parents that were just in denial that that was going to hurt the city, the county, and everyone, everybody's children's quality of life. And now I'm in Vance County, and I have to admit that where I live, I have one child in a charter school, the other one in a private school, because the school where I live, my children would not get a good enough education unless I had to pay for school or get them in charter. And charter requires volunteer hours. And I do believe that they don't have as many African-American parents because they don't have the ability. A lot of them here in Vance County are working jobs where they're struggling to just pay the rent. They don't have time to volunteer.
All right. Well, Cindy, let's get a response. Thank you for your call. The number is 877-962-9862. Jack?
Vance County is one of the five plaintiff counties in the Leandro low-wealth school case in which Vance and other counties say, we simply don't have enough resources to do well by any of our children. And the courts have tended to look upon that claim favorably. They haven't looked specifically at Vance County, but that's another complicating factor where some school systems have lots of money for each child and some have much less. You have inequities that can arise that really ought to be fixed. And some of that's racialized because some of the counties that are the poorest are counties that are predominantly African American or Latino.
What's the impact of things like No Child Left Behind? Here's a program designed to bring everybody's standards up by holding all schools to a standard, and that is supposed to raise all votes.
Well, I think there's some major concerns about how that was funded by the current administration. The concept No Child Left Behind, which was actually a phrase first used by Jesse Jackson down in Texas, actually, is and it's a playoff of that, you know, not leaving any soldier behind. In Goldsboro, it would probably be good, but what our high school did, I think they've stopped taking the Title I money. Now, isn't this interesting? In an inner city school with poor kids, where you know 80% or at least 70% of them are free lunch, they're eligible for Title I money. Now we're not receiving. So we've been asking why. Why are you not receiving this money? And what we have come to the conclusion is you don't receive the money, then you don't come under the federal mandate.
Mm-hmm. So you don't have to play by those rules.
You don't have to play by those rules.
What about some of the other alternatives? Let's look at charter schools, magnet schools. Are they a way to help end the trend to resegregate? Can they help integrate schools? If people have the money in their hands and can choose the best school, will we see schools become integrated again?
Based on our work, it's unlikely that charter schools are going to do much to stem the tide in the direction of resegregation. Charter schools in the state of North Carolina actually increase the overall measure of segregation.
877-962-9862 is the number to call. Allison is on the line from Chapel Hill. Hello, Allison.
Hi there. There's so many things that have struck a chord. The initial thing today was the caller who said that everyone in his generation who had experienced integrated schools wanted their children in segregated schools because they wanted to spare them that. I was both horrified and emphatic in saying I have two young adult children who are both graduate school graduates and professionals who specifically looked for homes in neighborhoods that were both culturally and racially diverse, where the schools their children went to would be culturally and racially diverse, because they both feel that the primary thing they got from their public school education was not book knowledge, but knowledge of how to get along with people of varying backgrounds, moral values, cultural values. And so that certainly there is hope. There are many young people out there, I think, who share that perspective and don't support public schools. As a former teacher in Cumberland County, and my daughter has taught school in, Pender County, now lives in Wake County, the No Child Left Behind sounds noble, but it would not seem like rocket science to me to say that in the schools where the children score the lowest, those are the schools that need the most resources pumped at them, and yet the system is teachers in those schools don't get bonuses, the schools don't get extra funding, it goes to the schools that are already doing a better job, and that's so...
Yeah, well,
contrary to the need.
Let's get a response to that, too. And thank you for your call, Allison. Charlie?
I'm not a political scientist, and so I shouldn't probably be making the following statement, but it seems to me that so much of this problem is a political one. Among many whites in the nation and in the state, there is resistance to integrated schools and the problems that people deal with. Among non-white parents, there is often a resistance to what's the use of going through this exercise when other people don't want to do it, and then we have school boards across the country who have to make these decisions because of the kind of decisions that Jack has pointed out. Nobody is looking over the shoulder of many of these school systems, and so it ultimately becomes a local question.
Well, Reverend Barber, I have less than a minute left, and I don't mean to leave you with that little time, but well, how do you see the future? We've moved into resegregation. Are we moving out, and what can help us?
Well, I'm commanded to hope, and I believe this new generation is going to bring it. One of the concerns I have is that some of the people promoting the policy on local school boards, their reality was segregation, and they still kind of live in that, I think, subliminally. But I think we got to make it a political issue. It's got to be a moral issue. We've got to have what I call prophetic social consciousness discussion about this. We need black leadership to step up to the plate. We need the state, in terms of funding, to look at this issue, because just like the federal government says they won't do put money in if you don't do certain things, the state ought to say the same thing if we're committed to One North Carolina.
Thank you very much, Reverend William Barber, pastor of the Greenleaf Christian Church in Goldsboro. Thank you. Charles Klotfelter is a professor of public policy and economics at Duke University. Jack Boger is a professor of law at UNC Chapel Hill, co-editor of the new book, School Resegregation, Must the South Turn Back? That's the state of things for today. Thanks for listening. If you have a comment, you can drop us an email at sot@wunc.org. Support for the state of things comes from listeners who support North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. I'm Frank Stachow.